Welcome to Bedford County Speaks, a weekly public affairs program that introduces you to the work, lives, and lifestyles in Bedford County. Today's program over News Talk 1310 WBFD is hosted by Lloyd Roach. Bedford County Speaks is heard every Saturday at this time. Now let's join Lloyd for this week's discussion on Bedford County Speaks.
Thank you, Matt DeFazio, and good morning to you. Welcome to Bedford County Speaks, the weekly public affairs program over News Talk 1310 WBFD. Today's program is presented as a public service by Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, right here on Route 220 in Bedford. That's Thomas, saving you time, money, and worry for over 100 years. I'll return in a moment with today's guest, District Attorney Bill Higgins, when Bedford County Speaks continues.
This is Carla Amato of Bedford Banjo Shop. Listen for Bedford County Speaks with Lloyd Roach, Saturdays at 8:30 a.m., right here on News Talk 1310 WBFD.
We did this a little while back. We came to the District Attorney's office and we visited Bill Higgins. First of all, Bill, I want to thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. I know you're a busy, busy guy.
Yep, happy to be here with you. Appreciate
it. The whole opioid thing is enormous now. Every politician has jumped on this, from God knows who, Senator Halftrack to, you know, Congressman whoever. There's a big push now to try to reduce the amount of legal and illegal opioids in the hands of children. And you here in the DA office see this every day, and that's why I wanted to talk with you. I've seen your comments in the press about the drug problem. I don't want to call it epidemic, but a problem you have here in Bedford County. And it seems to be very forefront. I am confused about an issue that I want to talk to you about. Many of the states, especially the wacky ones like Oregon, Washington, and those guys out there, have legalized marijuana for recreational use. While at the same time, their congressmen and senators get up in the United States Congress and say we shouldn't have opioids. There's a disconnect in my mind here. Could you explain this to us a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think you hit the nail right on the head there. We are sending extreme mixed messages to our youth. We have leaders in our government that advocate strongly for the recreational use of marijuana, and then come out and say, we got to do something about the opioid problem. And the message you're sending to kids is, you know, it's okay to get high, just do it with the drugs that we think are better for you to get high with, not these drugs. And it's a real problem. I mean, I think there's a real hypocrisy to these elected officials that advocate so strongly for recreational marijuana and then say they want to do something about the opioid problem. We're putting the wrong message into the heads of our children. You know, I think part of the view is, well, okay, so for your generation, it was okay to get high with marijuana, but our generation, you have a problem with us getting high using opioids. It should be a problem to get high for no reason at all, period, end of sentence. And we need to pull that back and, you know, really take a hard look at what's going on. It's no coincidence that the rise in interest to legalize marijuana has directly coincided with the rise in the opioid problem. People don't want to say that. People don't want to admit that. And they work hard to find data to contradict those statements like that. And they laugh at people like me who say that. But, you know, I've been doing this for 17 years. And, you know, each year, the interest in legalizing marijuana seems to grow with great fervor, and so does the problem that we have with opioid addiction.
On the 12th of January this year, there was an article in the New York Times, which astounded me to begin with, saying that it's been confirmed by several physicians and others, and people like you, that marijuana is still a gateway drug. Do you see that here in Bedford County?
Without question. You're not going to find anybody who woke up one day and started using opioids, abusing opioids. You ask them their story, and a good number of times, marijuana is an early part of that story. Some of the counter arguments that are, oh, so is alcohol. Yeah, that's right. But, you know, we went down that road with prohibition, and, you know, alcohol is a legal substance that we have in this country. And just because that's also what could be arguably a gateway to drug usage doesn't mean that, you know, we should then all of a sudden legalize marijuana because that's also a gateway drug.
But alcohol doesn't lead to drugs.
Not always, right. I mean,
And you know, if you have a beer, it doesn't mean you all of a sudden become hooked on vodka.
But the proponents of this argument would say that, you know, most people who our opioid addictions, the first mind-altering substance they used was alcohol. And then it led to marijuana, then it led to cocaine or pills, and now ultimately it's led to heroin and sticking a needle in their arm. Yes, but that marijuana always seems to be a consistent first or second step in that chain of events. You know, there are other stories. A lot of stories we hear are about people who were overprescribed medication, or their doctor prescribed medication when they probably shouldn't have and didn't monitor it the way they should have. And then that spiraled out of control. And I can talk more about that as we go on. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, yeah, marijuana is a gateway drug, and everybody acknowledges that. And the best arguments against it really are usually that, oh, well, so is alcohol. Well, that's a terrible argument, in my opinion. Marijuana is a gateway drug. We shouldn't be promoting it, glorifying its usage. But, you know, our previous president was glorifying the usage of marijuana not too long ago. These are the wrong messages we're sending to our children.
Do our local law enforcement agree with this opinion that these gateway drugs really do lead to what we used to call a life of crime?
Look, if you get involved in drugs, you're going to be in a position where you're not able to hold a job, and you're going to need money to pay for this addiction. So it's this cycle that just perpetuates itself out of control, and that's where it leads to stealing or robbing or hurting people for money to pay for the addiction. So yeah, it's spirals way out of control. And you know, even in these places where marijuana has been legalized, right, employers are still drug testing and fire employees. It's still company policies to not do it. You look even in Colorado, a law enforcement officer is not allowed to use marijuana. That's a violation of their employment guidelines. So we hear all the time that, you know, recreational marijuana is being legalized places, but employers still don't want it in their businesses. And they're still drug testing employees, and they're still terminating employees who are high.
Yeah.
And that's one of the arguments in favor. Hey, mm-hmm. people are going to smoke marijuana anyway. We might as well tax it and promote our government. But, you know, just because the government can make money on something doesn't mean we should now condone it. There's a lot of ways you can make money that promote bad behavior. And we shouldn't just go down those roads just because there's money in it. I'm sure there's money in prostitution and all kinds of other ills in this society. So, you know, the arguments that there's money in it are not good. But yeah, that's why you see all those people get involved in it, because it's profitable.
Yeah, I see.
I'll add one other thing. Even in these places where they've legalized marijuana, there's still a black market for it. It's still, you know, the people get a license and they can make a certain amount of marijuana. But they've found time and again that people are making more than what they're legally allowed to make, and it's going out the back door. So we haven't, you know, closed the black market on marijuana just because it's been legalized in a few places. You know, in some of those places, they're selling it and manufacturing it and taking it out of state. So it's the government should have never got involved in this issue. It'd be one thing to decriminalize it or lower the penalties, but to legalize it, promote it, tax it, it's out of control at this point.
Our guest is Bill Higgins, the district attorney of Bedford County. And Bill, I'm going to pull you back to Bedford County for just a second. You deal with law enforcement every day. I guess you are the chief law enforcement officer here. And every day they bring you cases where these things are involved in the case. And have you seen a pattern over the last, say, 10 years you've been doing this? Has this gotten worse?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's gotten worse. The addiction issues have gotten worse. It's just more widespread. This is a situation where, you know, you see it come from good families, bad families. It doesn't affect any one particular socioeconomic class.
So it isn't just the underside or the underbelly.
It's unfortunately across the board. And anybody, any family is, you know, a potential victim of this issue.
Because you see things on television, it's always like the underside of society, the dark, you know, at night in the streets kind of ghetto look to feel into everything. But you're telling me it's happening in private schools.
Oh,
things like this.
Yeah, not like that anymore. You're seeing more, you know, like I say this all the time, good people come from bad families, bad people come from good families. You can't just say, well, this family's in a particular situation, so mm-hmm. they're more susceptible to it.
Right.
We've had a lot of, you know, very, you know, successful people who their children have gotten involved with this stuff. They've done almost everything they could as a parent to be supportive and to give their kids the right education. And it's usually just really one bad choice that spirals out of control is what leads to this stuff.
without giving any names or anything, is there any way you could give me kind of a little case study of how this thing happens, for maybe where it begins, maybe something that you've experienced here?
Well, there's multiple paths, yeah. But one of the ones that I touched on it a little bit here was somebody gets a prescription for an opioid, a pain medication, for a legitimate reason, and begin by taking a little too much of it. Maybe their doctor's not paying close attention to the situation. They're on it for a little too long, and they become addicted to it. And then they need more, and the doctor's not giving them more. So they start trying to buy it on the street. Pills are expensive. And sooner or later, they realize that there's an economic solution to this, and that's heroin. Mm. So they buy heroin, and they can get the heroin cheaper, and they need less of it to get high. And this is a solution for them, for their short-term, what they think is a short-term problem. Not realizing how addictive this stuff is and how dangerous it is. And it just totally spirals out of control from there.
What does heroin cost?
You could get a bag of heroin for $20.
Oh, you can?
Yeah. I mean, heroin's cheap.
So as a result of this addiction, it's got to louse up your life. So as a result, you probably lose your job because you didn't pass a drug test at one of these large companies around here.
Or you're showing up high and the employer can't have that. I mean, not necessarily even need to – sometimes you don't even need the drug test. Mm-hmm. You have an unreliable employee now, or an employee that shows up and is unproductive because of their condition. So, yeah, it's killing people's and their opportunities for employment. So they're losing their job, and now they need an even – or a better economic solution to their problem. So now, even though they've found a cheaper drug that they can use to treat their addiction, they don't even have money to get that. So they got to steal to get that or sell some of the product to get that. So they get engage in even worse behavior.
Does a drug conviction pretty much shoot your employment opportunities to hell for a while? I mean, are you
at least for the
out
short
of the market?
Term, I would tell you there are a lot of very good employers who are willing to give in this area, who are willing to give people second chances if they believe they're sincere about it. And mm-hmm. we're very fortunate in that regard.
Right.
I know several employers who will look at somebody's situation and give them a chance. So, for somebody who has something like this in their past, I don't want them to think, hey, their life's over. They're never going to be able to turn their life around, because there are more and more employers who are willing to give people that second chance if they see that they're being sincere. They'll probably keep a close eye on them. And sometimes it works out. A lot of times it doesn't. But we are very fortunate to have employers in this area who are willing to give those second chances.
And I know in my previous interview with you, you told me that you sometimes broker these arrangements.
I know.
Where people are getting off of the stuff or getting out of jail or wherever they've been. And you actually talk to the employer and say, maybe this guy can make it.
I've done that a few times. If I thought somebody was very sincere in their efforts, I saw that they went through rehabilitation. I've talked to their employers and said, hey, maybe you want to give this guy a chance. And I give sometimes criminal defendants the names of employers who are willing to give those chances. And sometimes those matchups have worked out well. Sometimes they haven't. But I try not to get discouraged because of the bad outcomes, and instead try to stay encouraged because of the good outcomes.
Our guest is Bill Higgins, and you're listening to Bedford County Speaks. My name is Lloyd Roach, and just want to remind you today our program is brought to you in part by Bedford County Chamber of Commerce, who proudly supports and celebrates the business community of the Bedford County region. To learn more, visit them online at bedfordcountychamber.com. And also by the Omni Bedford Springs, who has this really, really cool thing coming up on the 29th and 30th of April called Navy Radioman Day. And we'll be telling you about that a little bit later when Bedford County Speaks continues.
Hello, I'm Mark Thomas. Perhaps while driving around Bedford County lately, you may have noticed our current outdoor billboards. Stephanie March, General Manager of Thomas Chevrolet Subaru, knows better than anyone about our mission of total satisfaction. When we talk about our 7 ways to save, we mean not only are we saving you money, but also saving you some time and aggravation. Our attention to complete satisfaction makes sure you're happy with our vehicles and service, which keeps us happy to have a loyal customer. Our 7 ways to save is a process to ensure you have complete information to make the decision that's best for you when you purchase a car or truck. We encourage you to visit Thomas Chevrolet Subaru right here in Bedford and see for yourself why our goal is your complete satisfaction. Visit us on Business Route 220 north of Bedford, or visit us 24/7 online at thomaschevrolet.com.
This is Sergeant Dennis Gulick of the Pennsylvania State Police, and you're listening to Bedford County Speaks over News Talk 1310 WBFD.
Now, let's head back to today's Bedford County Speaks.
We have returned, and we are in the historic courthouse here in Bedford County with its district attorney, Bill Higgins, and we've been talking about this this horrible opioid and marijuana conundrum, let's call it something like that. Much of the county is taken care of by the Pennsylvania State Police. Do they get special training for this?
Yeah, they participate in regular updates and training, and our local officers do as well. We try to work very closely with our local officers and get them
to Bedford and Hyman and Everett and all that. Yeah,
and, you know, people ask sometimes what we get, what we do with our forfeiture money. That's one of the things that we will forfeit the assets of a drug dealer when we prosecute them. One of the things we do with that money is to get officers better trained, send them to training on issues like this, and buy equipment that's going to help them in their investigations. So, yeah, and then the state police as a whole, they have their statewide training programs that they participate in. And, you know, we have very well-trained police officers, both with the state police and our local police departments working on these issues.
Well, because it just seems to me that being a cop today is completely different what it was like to be a cop 30 years ago. I mean, all these things have become almost like a social train wreck. It isn't just bad guys robbing a store or, you know, getting in an OK Corral shootout or something. It's all connected now, isn't it?
Because
we hear about these terrible shootouts they have with police officers. And 50% of the time, we find out that the perpetrator was on some kind of drug.
Yeah.
So he wasn't even home when that was happening. He didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, unfortunately, the vast majority of our crime has some connection to drug activity, whether not just the drug usage itself, but people making bad decisions because they're high on drugs, people stealing to pay for drugs, people fighting over a drug debt or stealing from a loved one to pay for their drug habit. You know, if you could just take that out of the equation, we would have a significant decrease in criminal activity. Absolutely.
So this is often the driver.
Yeah. The other increase we've seen over the years is the increase in impaired driving related to controlled substances. You know, when I started as a prosecutor 17 years ago, I'd have less than half a dozen of those cases a year. I easily have a dozen of those cases a month now. So it's there's been a significant increase of that. One of the problems there is the prescription drugs. A lot of people have the mentality that, well, if I'm prescribed a drug, it's okay for me to drive and under the influence of that drug. And it's not. It's no different than alcohol. It's not illegal to drink alcohol. It's illegal to drive your car when you're drunk. It may not be illegal to take your prescription drug. And a big player in this is the some of the drugs that are used to control drug abuse, like methadone, Suboxone. These are drugs that are prescribed by somebody to help somebody wean off of heroin. But people drive under the influence of these things.
I see.
You know, it's a crime.
So that
we've
stuff
seen a great
becomes,
increase in that, too.
Yeah, so that stuff becomes a drug unto itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I had a girl one time, we were dealing with her, and she said she was going to be on probation and she couldn't use drugs. And I said, well, you know, she wanted to know if she could use her prescription drugs. She told me she was on Suboxone. I said, well, how long have you been on Suboxone? She said, 8 years. I said, well, that defeats the whole purpose. I mean, you're supposed to get off of heroin, start using the Suboxone, slowly wean off of that, and live a drug-free life.
Right.
We've gotten to the point where, you know, that's acceptable to just live a life on Suboxone or methadone, and that's also a problem.
I want to talk a little bit about kids. We see things sometimes in the printed media, little lists of things that parents should look out for in their children. Can you provide us a little bit of guidance on that?
You know, the biggest one is just changed behavior. You know, your kids. And if they're changing their behavior, you got to find out why. You got to find out what's going on. You can't just stick your head in the sand and ignore this problem. And the other issue is parents trying to be a friend to their kid. You know, you want to be a friend to your kid, but you got to be a parent first. And there's too many parents out there that want to be their kid's best friend, want their kids to, you know, like them. And really what you need them to do is just respect you and listen to you. And those are real issues. But, you know, we get parents who do see the signs and try to do something about it. And they're at a loss sometimes of what to do, because as these kids get older and they don't listen to their parents, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to restrain them and hold them down. So I see a lot of parents that are in these situations that are doing everything right, and it's still not working out.
Yeah.
But, you know, watch for those signs. Be there as a support to your child. Make sure you get them into treatment if you can. And the other thing is, don't fight the system. The kids that I see, the young people that I see that succeed in licking this thing, when they come to court, their parents are in our corner, on our side, saying, hey, look, my kid needs help. The kids who don't succeed are the parents who, when they come to court, are not on our side. They're against the DA. They're against the police. They're against the probation office. They feed into the story that their kid's given them about how somehow it's the whole world against them and, you know, everybody's out to get them. You know, most of the time, I don't even know these people. They get arrested, but
I'm suspecting you hear this sometimes.
Yeah, and somehow I'm the bad guy for prosecuting them, and everybody thinks that we're somehow out to get their kid. And usually, I didn't even know who this person was until they got arrested. But now because we're prosecuting the case and expect to hold them accountable or to get help, we're the bad guys. And the parents that feed into that are not helping their children at all. We've seen the greatest success cases where the parent works with the DA and the judge and the probation office to keep their kid clean and report it. You know, just because some parents see their kid's on probation for a drug case, they see their kid getting high. Rather than report it to the probation officer, they help them cover it up, you know, help make excuses for them, why they can't be at their drug testing appointment or something like that.
When you said look for changes in your children, when my children were adolescents, they turned into horrible people. But it wasn't because of drugs they
got.
But a parent knows if there's
they
a difference
know.
Between being a horrible 13-year-old or having some drug influence.
You're right. You're certainly, as a teenager gets older, they're going to do things that you don't like. That doesn't mean they're on drugs.
Right.
But, you know, physical appearance is a big one. Kids that are, in their teens, they should look healthy. And if they're skinny and their skin's breaking out, traditional acne, I'm talking about sores on their face, their teeth are falling out of their head, they're not cleaning themselves anymore. I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many times somebody comes in here, we look at them and say, the kid's on drugs, and the parent looks at me like, well, no, they're not. Well, you got to pay attention. I mean, is your kid supposed to look like that? Right. You know, kids should look healthy. And if they're not healthy, a doctor should be telling you why they don't. And, get your kid to a doctor if they don't look healthy, and hopefully they'll give you a diagnosis and tell you that, you know, that they're suffering some type of illness that you could treat. But most doctors in those situations are going to tell you your kid's on drugs. You can't just look the other way. You got to take this thing head on.
Is a teacher in school allowed to report some suspected drug activity if they see it?
Yeah, absolutely.
How does that work?
They could. If a teacher could report it. We get reports like that from teachers and school administrators. They should work up their chain of command, and take it to the school administration and do things like that. But they should certainly – I mean, their job is to look out for the well-being of kids too. And if they see something of concern, they should bring that to the attention of their administrators and work through their system. But I'll tell you, I talked to a lot of teachers – They get it worse than me, where the parents don't support them at all. These poor teachers anymore. You know, when I was a kid, if the teacher said I did something wrong, I never got a chance to explain myself.
Right.
It's not like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, if the teacher says you did something wrong, they don't give the teacher a chance to explain what happened. They immediately assume that the kid's right, and they go to battle with the school and the administrators. So they're banging their heads off the wall too. I mean, all this stuff is tied together. We can't live in a bubble and act like this drug problem has nothing to do with the poor parenting that's going on and the parents who want to fight with teachers and police officers and law enforcement officials. It's all tied together. We have sent terrible messages to our kids, and now we're trying to unring that bell, and it's going to be almost impossible until we really just knuckle down and say we're going to go back to the way it used to be. Not everybody needs, this special attention that we want to give them.
Our guest is Bill Higgins, the district attorney of Bedford County, and we are getting a really PhD lesson here on what you should look for in your children. Bill, do the faith community, the churches help with this at all in Bedford County?
In fact, we've been very fortunate in that regard. Treatment is expensive. It's very expensive. And even when people want to get into treatment, it's hard to find funding for it. There is some funding through the government, There are some programs like that. There are private programs where a person can pay an exorbitant amount of money to get their loved one into a program. But there's also religious-based programs. Hmm. The tough thing about the religious-based programs is they're often very affordable, if not free, for the addict. But there's a religious component to that.
Sure.
And the reason I say it's unfortunate is because of that religious component, we can't force people into those treatments. So we have some treatments that we can put people into that are secular in nature, that cost money. And we have some programs like that. Uh-huh. And but the religious-based ones, we can't force people into that because, you know, the First Amendment. And
because that's elective.
Right. So people are going to come back and say you're forcing religion on people. You know, although I look at that and say, you know, is that really so bad? You know, maybe that's what you need, a little more religion in your life to some of these people. But that's obviously offensive to some people. You know, those programs have worked. I've used a few of those, and usually voluntary. But if an offender will come and say, hey, I want to get into this program, there's one called Teen Challenge. Mm-hmm. It's a year-long program. It's religious-based. We've put people through that program, and they come out a whole different person.
So if they say to you, let's say that they're before your court, and they say to you, okay, I've decided to go into Teen Challenge, and that'll qualify as a mitigation for what you want them to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if they elect to do it, I mean.
Yeah. Absolutely. We've done that quite a bit.
I see.
What I try to avoid is these defendants that are just doing the math. You know, I'm a big believer in long-term programs. The longer, the better. 28-day programs, yeah, they work occasionally, but the real success has come from these 9-month or 13-month programs. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I think one of them is if you're out of your life, your everyday life for a whole year, you've missed at least one of everything. You've missed a birthday. You've missed a Christmas. You missed an Easter. You missed your loved one's birthday. You missed so many things. You don't want to miss those things again. When people go to 28-day programs, they usually schedule things around that so that they could get in and get out and never really missed much of their life.
And also, it didn't take them 28 days to get into this difficulty in the
first
place.
You're not going to get out of it in 28 days.
Yeah.
Right?
So, I mean, I guess it's linear. If you've been doing this for a couple of years, it's going to take you a couple of years to unwind it.
Sure.
Seem to me, you know, like any other habit.
Absolutely. So what we get concerned about is if a defendant's doing the math and says, all right, so you'll put me in this 13-month program, but if I plead guilty, the judge probably won't give me 6 months. So I'd rather sit in jail for 6 months than go to a 13-month treatment program. Well, that's true. A lot of times that is true. That tells me, one, the person's not very sincere about it. Two, they're probably not going to get the help that they need because their heart's not in it. The ones that impress me are somebody who's looking at maybe 30 days in jail, but they check themselves into a 9-month rehab program instead.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll do a lot to help them. We'll reduce charges. We'll do whatever we can because you want to be known as a tough prosecutor, you're tough on crime, but you also want people to know you have a heart. And that's a tough balance, and it's one that I struggle with all the time.
But that's also got to be selfish in a way, because you don't want them to come back.
Absolutely.
You want them to be fixed. You don't want to bring them back in here for a second or third or fourth time.
Right, and if we make a decision on how we're going to handle a case, whether it be put somebody in jail for a long time or put them into a rehab or whatever we do with it, you know, one of my measures of success is, am I seeing this guy again? And if I'm seeing them again, then maybe we didn't address the problem right the first time, and that's a life lesson. We learn from that. So we try to do a whole lot of creative things to help people. We want people to beat this thing. We don't want to see people in this endless cycle of addiction.
Our guest is Bill Higgins, and we're going to wrap up with Bill in just a second. I want to remind you that I mentioned earlier that the Omni Bedford Springs has a great event coming up on the 29th and 30th, which is a Saturday and Sunday of April. And you may or may not know, but they had a rather substantial Navy radio school operating at the Springs between 1943 and 1944. And they're going to celebrate the 75th anniversary of that whole activity up there. They're going to have Dennis Tice talking about World War II. There's going to be an actual demonstration of Navy radiomen. There's going to be some equipment there that you can see. And there's going to be uniforms from World War II. And they're going to show a special showing of Casablanca on the movie screen.
Nice.
So if you want to come and see it. It's the Omni Bedford Springs. Just call their office, the Omni Bedford Springs, right here in Bedford, for Navy Radioman Day, the 29th and 30th of April. Bill, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. As always, I come here and I learn a lot. I know you've got to rush off and do a case now, but I just really appreciate you taking the time to do this with us.
I always look forward to our time together.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it very much. Bedford County Speaks was presented this morning by Thomas Chevrolet Subaru on Route 220 in Bedford, saving you time, money, and worry for over 100 years. I look forward to joining you next time right here on News Talk 1310 WBFD. Until then, enjoy your weekend. This is Lloyd Roach.
You have been listening to Bedford County Speaks. Listen each Saturday beginning at 8:30 to hear about the work, lives, and lifestyles in Bedford County. Bedford County Speaks is a presentation of the News and Public Affairs Department of News Talk 1310 WBFD. Thanks for listening.